This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at www.teachbetterpodcastnetwork.com. Now let's get on to the episode.
Welcome to the Counter Narrative Podcast, a show designed to change the way we talk and think about education. By sharing stories of successes and triumphs, we aim to challenge the dominant narrative that often negatively portrays our disenfranchised populations. I'm your host, Charles Williams, an urban educator for more than 15 years, a current school principal in Chicago, an educational consultant, an equity advocate, and the co-host of Inside the Principal's Office. Let's get started. Hello and welcome back to the Counter Narrative Podcast. As always, I'm excited to be in this space with you. And today's show is going to be a little bit different because it's not just me and a guest. It's me and three different guests. And as we were chatting, it was interesting. We have one guest who is joining us again on the show. It will be her third time. I think you are the record holder at this point. So I'm anticipating the messages. Like, how come she gets to be on there three times?
I'm persistent.
There you go. That's right. And you're doing amazing work. So there's always something to talk about. We have one individual who we crossed paths with a few years ago. And, you know, just the way things work, we kind of fell apart, but we've reconnected. And so, you know, it's a beautiful thing there. And I'm making a new friend. So by the time this conversation is over, I'm hoping that we will be not just like Twitter sphere people, but, you know, like we've now connected. So I'm going to pause a moment. We'll just go around the circle. Tell us a little bit about who each of you are. Typically, you know, what is your name? What are you doing right now in education? Kind of your journey there. And then we'll jump into the show. So Dr. Ingrid, since it's your first time connecting with me, talk a little bit about who you are. What are you doing?
Yes. Thank you, Charles. I'm so excited to go beyond the Twitter sphere. That's funny you say that. My name is Ingrid Twyman, and I am located in Southern California. That's where I spent most of my educational career, in the Los Angeles area, working in middle schools as a teacher, principal, instructional coach, residency director. And then recently, the last couple of years, I've kind of moved into the consulting space and gotten to work and with a few partner groups, one being the Core Collaborative, which brought us all together, which we're so happy for that, which we'll talk about in a second, and currently working with schools around how to enact culturally responsive and sustaining education, and how to elevate practices with a cultural lens.
Michigan, grew up here, and my education journey started as an elementary teacher, and I was a middle school teacher. I became a elementary and secondary principal, and then moved on to consulting. And my jam is really looking at instructional practices and questioning. And I was really excited when this team invited me to contribute to the Amplify book and speak about inclusive questioning. So it really was a wonderful learning experience. And I'm always, as you know, I've been on the podcast before and always looking to just grow my experiences and better myself as a human to make sure that I'm being as kind and as accepting as I can of everyone.
Well, Connie, thank you again for being here. And if you're listening and you're like, wait a minute, I haven't heard any of those episodes, feel free to go back and check them out. I'll make sure to include those in the show notes. You will not be disappointed. And last but not least, we're going to bring in Isaac.
Hey, everyone. I'm Isaac Wells. Similar to the others, I began in elementary education, teaching kindergarten, second grade, fourth grade, and fifth grade. And then working as an instructional coach and school improvement specialist in my home district. And through that work, met our CEO and founder at the Core Collaborative, Paul Bloomberg, and he kind of invited me out on the road. And for the last 8 years or so, that's been part of my journey, getting to travel around and work with amazing schools, in districts across the U.S., which is why I'm in an airport right now. And with the Core Collaborative now, I'm the director of teaching and learning. So I get to work with all these amazing consultants like Connie and Ingrid, and just get to kind of be the go-between sometimes with other people on the team and with the schools and districts we serve. And as they both said, was just really thrilled to be a part of this amazing author team on this project, Amplify Learner Voice, that we worked on with Paul Bloomberg, Kara Vandis, Babette Dukes, Rachel Carrillo Fairchild, and then the three of us.
Yeah, so I know that we've mentioned a few times, and so I don't know which one of you want to jump in and explain just a little bit. So we've mentioned the Core Collaborative, right? And in fact, it's the title of this episode, Interview with the Core Collaborative, because it's a little shorter than mentioning everybody by name. So could you share a little bit about what is the Core Collaborative? What does that look like? How can somebody maybe partner with you if they want to get some of the awesome benefits that you all offer?
Isaac, that's you, I think.
I think so.
You got it. I was just waiting until an announcement was over. Yeah, so really what we are at our heart is a learning network. So we have this massive group of educators across the states and around the world who are dedicated to cultivating self-empowered learners, which is our version of assessment-capable learners, and who are dedicated to creating the conditions for collective teacher efficacy for educators that we work with. And kind of what we do is we're a group of consultants who bring our different lived experiences and expertise to bear to partner with other educators to help them identify and address whatever puzzles of practice they may have. And yeah, if you want to connect with us, you can just search thecorecollaborative.com and you can find us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, or any of those other social media outlets.
All right. Thank you. And of course, you could do that after you listen to this episode.
Yes. So yeah. Keep listening.
Stick around for a little bit. So the reason why we're all here today is because of an amazing book that you all wrote, Amplify Learner Voice, which, as I mentioned earlier on, just thank you for allowing me an opportunity to be one of the reviewers of the book and be able to write, a message within that book. I appreciate that opportunity. And as I mentioned in this, and I hope that we get a chance to talk, is one of the things that I love the most about this is that it's not a one or the other, right? So oftentimes in educational spaces, it's like, well, we're either doing A or we're doing B, and A and B happen to be at the polar opposites of a spectrum. And I've often thought, like, why does it have to be either or? Why can't it be a myriad? Why can't it be a marriage of these different ideas? And that is exactly what you all did. You were like, here's these great theories, here are these great ideologies, let's marry them into this kind of cohesive unit and use that to drive this initiative forward. So I want to say thank you, not just for allowing me to be a part of the process, but really for putting this out, because I think it's going to make a huge impact in the world of education. So let's kick off right within that vein. You know, the whole point of this show is pushing back on that dominant narrative. And well, assessments have been around forever. We talk a lot about the ideas of high-stakes standardized assessments that have been kind of the go-to, right? Or multiple choice, right? Again, kind of this like extreme ends. So talk to me a little bit about why this book, why was there a need for shifting the conversation around assessment?
I mean, I can kind of start. I think, and Isaac, you could, and Connie, maybe more just about the actual practices of formative assessment. But I know that at Core Collaborative, that's been kind of a backbone of the work that the partnerships have formed around, again, creating assessment capable learners and the formative assessment process, which is something that we can control in the classroom. And teachers have some, you know, without feeling that stress of the high stakes testing, they know their students. And so the more opportunities that we can have to give students a chance to shine and show what they know in many, many, many different ways, the better, the more we know about where they are. Students know where they are, where they need to go, and what those next steps are for learning. So that process has kind of been in place for a while and came kind of from one of the original books, Peer Power. And so kind of when this project came about, Paul Bloomberg was looking at the original book and saying, okay, what can we do to kind of flip it a little bit and reframe? And so that's when we started bringing in all of these great partners, like Connie and Kara was original, but Vivette, and getting these different perspectives, where we wanted to take kind of this body of research around culturally responsive sustaining education and marry those two, like you said. And we they kind of had been sitting separate, you know, for a while, and thinking about what is the idea of formative assessment process and why is that so important for all of our students to have the opportunity to show what they know, their funds of knowledge through their cultural strengths, which are often missed opportunities in classrooms because of this high stakes testing and traditional assessments and the pressure that teachers are under. I mean, the intent is there. Teachers are definitely wanting to do, I think, some of this work. It's just having the permission and a sense to be able to go that route. So we're trying to bring some ideas to the table so we can kind of push our thinking around assessment in the classroom.
Thank you.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, it's just the next step. The first thing we missed really with the formative assessment process in a lot of places in the States is that it is a process. And so we really thought of formative assessment as a product. Like, here's this formative assessment we're taking. Really, formative assessment is something we do. And so we clarify the learning progression. We co-create with the learners the learning intentions that help us know where we're going. What are our goals? Then we work on those success criteria to say, well, what's it going to look like when I do a good job with this? So all these kind of things pull us in, strengthen the impact of the feedback we provide and that students provide to themselves and to each other, and allow for some, you know, really significant growth when they can set goals, clarify a plan to achieve that, and then, you know, revise their thinking, revise, you know, the products they create. And so as Ingrid said, that's really been our focus for years. And so that pulled kids into the process. And then what we realized is there's still kind of a piece missing here, which is that a lot of this was coming from the dominant culture. So kind of that middle class white culture that school is steeped in. And so we were unintentionally forgetting to be driven by the assets that students bring. And so when we take time to learn about their home life, the cultural experiences they have, the lived experiences they have, then we bring that in. It just makes that entire process of co-construction so much richer, and it builds those connections again so that it's not just how do you connect to the learning, but how can the learning connect to you?
So that's powerful. I love this idea of saying we understand assessments. And Isaac, I like that idea that it's a process. It's not just something that we do. It's part of that learning journey, right? And so not only is that become just an ingrained part, so we're constantly giving you feedback. In fact, it's one of the things I try to push more and more that, you know, outside of that big summative, these formatives are critical, you know, to that learning journey. But it's also making sure is that how are we really capturing, right, those nuanced pieces that may be lost because of those cultural differences. And so, you know, I want to ask, you know, as we're pushing into this, you know, we're having this conversation, and I've heard this question asked, and so I want to broach it in this conversation. You know, we're having this conversation about culturally responsive, culturally sustaining, you know, assessments. And right now I'm in a recording, right? And this is nothing personal to any of you. And Connie, you and I have had a very honest conversation around this.
Yep, about, I know exactly where you're going.
Right? It's yep. Like, we're talking about culturally responsive, sure, culturally sustaining, and I'm having a conversation with three white educators. And so I know one of the questions I often hear is like, why are you the experts? Why are we, should we sit and have this conversation when we have, you know, three white educators here? And so I know people can't see that, right? But if they're looking through, if they're familiar with you, like, I'm sure that's a question. And so hearing that, what is one of your, what is your response?
Well, I think to start off, we're not the only authors on the book. So it definitely was a great collaborative effort. And there was a great desire and effort to make sure that multiple voices from various cultures were heard. So each of us bring our unique lens. And, you know, Charles, you and I have talked about this from my point of view in a really vulnerable way for me. And so I feel comfortable with you to say that when I was writing, one of the things that I shared with some of my colleagues was just that exact question, like, who am I to be saying these, and what angles am I missing? You know, I only have this one lived experience, and plenty of people on the planet have had really similar lived experiences as I have. And so some of what I chose to bring from my lens, rather than trying to look at what are the lived experiences and try to reiterate those perspectives, is what are the things that I've learned along the way as a white teacher, as a white educator, in the mistakes that I've unknowingly made that I can share with readers that create an awareness around some implicit bias. And really, really simple things like, whenever we're making instructional decisions, because most kids will anything, that should be a red flag for us to say that's probably a time that we should flip the way that we are instructing or assessing to cater more toward not most kids. Just because most kids in my classroom are Christian doesn't mean that I should start my lessons talking about Christianity and the church because it's familiar to, quote, most kids. Those are the students that already have an advantage, because that's the dominant conversation. And so when we have those perspectives and we can share those in a text to say we as educators should be looking for some of these really common thoughts that we have with the best of intentions, and try to flip the way that we consider those thoughts to look at who are we excluding. And sadly, we're doing that by design. When we sit at a planning table with our peers and say, well, most kids will understand XYZ, or the majority of our students have had this experience, and we feed off of that, the idea is we're building off of experiences that kids have that are common. But really what that does is it just further oppresses the students that haven't had those experiences, because they're now once again expected to come in at a specific level that they may not have those same experiences. So we're positioning them at a disadvantage out of the gate. So some of those components, that's the lens that I looked at when I contributed to the chapter on questioning, is what are some of the biases that we have that we may not be aware of, and how can we be more aware of it so that our assessments are more culturally inclusive?
Thank you, Connie.
And on a similar note, as somebody who, you know, you can look at across a room and recognize as someone who looks like the dominant culture, there's nobody better than me to be learning about this, because I've benefited from it my entire life. And so it could be very easy for me to be blind to differences in the world and how they, or not to differences in the world, rather.
It's all right, Isaac. There was an announcement coming through, but Isaac, I absolutely hear what you were saying. And I was thinking one of those same things, like, is there a benefit from saying, hey, we're having this conversation with individuals who may look exactly like us, who are the same people that we're saying, hey, we need to make some shifts and changes. And so does that help, you know, deliver that message a little better?
With one of our colleagues, Michael D'Souza, we're working on a series around really developing our racial literacy and understanding how to speak more honestly and openly about the impact of race and identity on education and on our learners. And one of the things we're working on is building cohorts of groups of people intentionally who identify as white, because these conversations need to be had, not most, but especially in the dominant culture, because that is still, for better or for worse, where a lot of the power lies to make changes. And we're all people who've been in education for a considerable amount of time. And so because of that, we have more ability, maybe not to change everything, but to influence And so with that, a larger responsibility might rely on me as a white educator who's been around for a few decades than someone who might be more impacted directly, seemingly, by some of these issues, but just hasn't had the opportunities I've had thus far. And so if I can't learn and change, then I'm really just not going to be able to have the impact that I should be having.
No, I appreciate that. So I'm curious, right? And right now we had a conversation. You are all kind of traveling the country right now, having these conversations, doing this most important work. And yet I know when I turn on the news almost every single morning, right, I'm seeing these bills being passed, this law is being passed, right, these ideas being presented that push back against this very work, right, which makes me wonder and worry about some of my colleagues located in places like, you know, Texas, right, Florida, you know, like these laws that are being passed. And so I'm curious, in your travels, and I'm sure you've come across individuals who are like, why is this important? Why do we need to have this idea about culturally responsive, culturally sustaining? And in reality, when we're saying that, we're not even necessarily just talking about race, right? It's one factor when we think about the word culture. But what is your typical response? Because I'm wondering, even though I would be very surprised if they're listening to the show, because that would be weird. I'm just getting trolled. But what would be one of your responses to somebody who pushes back on that?
It's so funny because we were literally talking about this today at the school that I was at. And in bringing this work into certain communities, like pushing back like from parents within the community. And so I think there's just, you know, for a lot of people, just there's a lot of fear of things that we don't know or we don't understand. So if we only, you know, things are spun very different ways in media. Around culturally responsive sustaining education being compared to critical race theory. And just when people don't really know enough about it, right, it gets a little fearful. And people, I think, feel afraid to talk about certain topics and also feel kind of that, I guess, in a sense, like, you know, shameful about some of the narratives that are out there and the ones that are being spun. So the way that we were literally talking about this a couple hours ago, because this is going to keep coming up and we want to our teachers to feel empowered enough to kind of stand, like, what is your stance? What do you, first of all, what do you believe about your students and what's best for your students? And I kind of been pushing myself too about, you know, we used to always say what's best, you know, so that we're reaching all students. And then I've been seeing somewhere, I can't remember where, about now doing what's best for each student. So now we're kind of more individualizing for students, because even within the all, kind of like your, we want to reach our student groups, but even within every student group, everyone is so different and so individual. So I'm pushing myself to reach each student, is to kind of think about, this is that really is like a humanizing pedagogy of a way of teaching, and the theories and their asset base and focusing on strengths and identity and for our kiddos to know who they are and feel so comfortable in their skin and to have a voice and to have academic success and to know all that through the formative assessment process, but getting feedback and working with their peers and pushing each other. Who wouldn't want that for any child, for anyone, no matter where you live, what zip code you're from? If we really want that, what's best for kids, that if you really want to have a conversation about it, that's really what it's about. It's about creating opportunities for students to be who they are, to be loved, heard, seen, valued, and to also push back against the dominant narrative, the counter narrative, the name of your podcast, right? Because that's a reality. We cannot hide that. We cannot dismiss it. But some people are more equipped and ready to have those conversations than others. And then when I hear pushback a lot, my go-to is in my thinking is why, like, why, where's that coming from? Why, what are the experiences that have influenced
that person to think that way in that moment, because there's always something. So I think when we even like as the pioneers in this work and the crusaders, if we even can slow down our thinking, because we get triggered, right? We can react and we want to jump to the, front and fight back. But there's, I think it's interesting to pause and just kind of think about where is this coming from? Because it is coming from someone's cultural experience. Unfortunately, it's indoctrinated from also, years, historically as well, the white dominant narrative in our country. But I think it's just opens up for conversation about who, what can we do in schools to create a more human experience so that everyone can be loved and seen and heard.
Dr. Tumman, I love the fact that you said, it's almost like we got to reach each to reach all, mm-hmm. right? Like if that's going to happen, and, it brings up this idea and continuing to push back on, this zero sum theory, right? There's mm-hmm. this fear, as you mentioned earlier, that, well, if you give to others, then I'm going to do without. And it's like, no, this idea is that it will benefit everyone in the space, like your child included. In fact, similar to you, I had a whole argument with someone about that. Like, well, you're teaching, your design is to make white people fail. And I was like, absolutely. Like, if that's the outcome, then it's being done wrong. Like, because that's not the idea either. It's this idea that everyone is involved. And one example that I remember, so many, many years ago, I was an EL teacher. And I remember like the WIDA, right? And so mm-hmm. And you would point to pictures and there were things in the pictures and the kids had to say it. And I remember there was a little, there was a little plate underneath the teacup and they had to name what that was. Right.
Oh, yeah.
And so like most of us are like, well, it's a plate. Like, no, it's a saucer. Like who uses that word anymore? Right. There's a very small group of people who might still go out and purchase saucers. And it was like, this is why. Right? Like you didn't say saucer. And so now you're dinged. And it was like, but I knew what it was. I had a different vocabulary word. So I'm appreciative of you doing this work. And so as I'm thinking about this, you have a few different chapters, right? This idea about like Connie's chapter, which I didn't know, but I was like, oh, I like this area about questioning. And it just so happened to be, I swear it's not favoritism. But I want to ask, like, if each of you had to choose like one of the areas of the book that you feel are the most potent or the most powerful. And I get it, right? Writing a book, you're like, well, they're all important. They're all special. But if you were like, this area, I think really stands out to me. And this is one of the areas that a reader should focus in on. What would it be and why? And so I'll just go around and feel free to hop off mute and jump in. Unless there's an airport announcement, Isaac.
Yeah. Well, I think what you just did by bringing in a practical example that everybody can understand, when you talked about the idea of like, how would I know this is a saucer? Like, I know the word for that object, but I didn't know the word you meant for it, but I do know it's a plate that you can put a cup on. And so I think that is the larger goal of the book, is to make this practical, to say, what can you do? And sometimes that's a way in, because these words, just as some words can trigger some of us, other words trigger other people. So we hear, cultural, sometimes that's a trigger for people. And then it takes us down this lane. But so we built all this around, like, what can you do for engagement? What can you do for learning partnership, for dispositional learning, learner clarity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so those seven core concepts make it practical to talk about what we're doing. And those are harder to argue against. Do you not want all learners to be engaged? And so with that said, even though it's not what I thought I was going to say when I started talking, I almost feel like maybe that kind of first chapter that clarifies some of those pieces might be something helpful. Because if you're listening to this podcast, this is something probably that you're already on this page. And so that might give you some more ideas or some more ways of talking that are different from what you've used in the past to help convince others who haven't had some of the experiences or some of the conversations we've been able to have. So I'll say maybe read that first chapter and get some ideas, or that introduction in first chapter, just to see how can we think about this differently, frame it a little bit differently. And that might be a way in with some of your colleagues.
Thank you.
And then maybe to dig in a little bit to looking at something more specific to kind of hone in, So of course I have to talk about questioning, but I think the biggest aha that I had when we were having these conversations and really thinking about how can we be inclusive in questioning is really about wondering how are we not being inclusive around questioning and asking that negative version of that question. Because, you know, we can always do more and we can always defend what it is that we think that we're doing and our intent. So when we reverse that question, what are we not doing? And part of it really has to do with what Ingrid said about being asset-based and really trying to make sure that we're taking what students can do. There's a lot of focus on, you know, the power of yet and Carol Dweck's work. And, you know, I think at the core, I really believe strongly. I've looked at the research that she's done, and there's a lot of good stuff that is in there, but it has been so generalized that this whole idea of growth mindset is that, you know, we can just, you can't do this yet. And so you have to keep going forward. And it's about still focusing on what kids can't do and trying to help them to have the confidence to be able to do something they cannot do. An asset-based approach takes a completely different foundational perspective, which is what can the student do? And then how can we use that to help leverage them to the next level? So instead of looking at a deficit perspective, which every needs assessment on the planet does, when we're doing assessments, we're looking at where are they lacking? What are the gaps? What do they not know yet? And this isn't to say that we should never do a needs assessment and that we should never assess where gaps are, but it is to say that we shouldn't exclusively be looking at that. And when we are lesson planning in order to address those areas, the lessons should be based on the strengths that students have and the positivity. And it's as simple as one of the examples is if you look at a student who is a slow reader in order to comprehend, then you might give some encouragement to say, you know, you'll get better, you'll get faster with more practice. Like, you're doing okay, you'll get better. Well, the whole idea of you'll get better is you're not good enough yet. And so instead of focusing on that, take a focus on, well, your comprehension is really strong because you took the time to slow down and read to make sure that you understood. And just that simple flip of looking for what is working, what can we elevate that students can do, just in something as simple as reading, like, right? That doesn't have to do with race or culture or anything, like just looking at what those strengths are. And then how can we take that method of thinking where we narrow in on strengths and assets and apply it to everything, not just what students, what they can do academically.
Thank you, Connie. I love this idea of the asset based. In fact, a lot of times when people ask about this show, that's one of the things that I mentioned is that, you know, we often have these negative conversations, right? And it's not just having a conversation, because if I'm a teacher and I'm having those conversations, it solidifies that perspective of me. And if that's how I'm looking at you and talking about you, then that solidifies it in you. And then, right. And then that cycle continues. So I love this idea of the asset based. So, Dr. Twyman, I'm sorry. What would you say is one of your favorite aspects of the book?
Yeah. And I think it's kind of going along what Isaac was saying too. The way that it's set up, what I think is really powerful is that the beginning does kind of give the introduction and kind of overview around culturally responsive, sustained education. But then Isaac mentioned, but maybe to really clarify that we, in doing this work, we had written what the first draft and got some really, really great feedback. And we saw all of these themes emerging from the manuscript, and where we came together and we said, wait, these just keep speaking to us. We need to put these together and kind of created a framework of these seven core concepts of what Isaac was talking about. And that just really helped, I think, structure the book. It helps structure our thinking. It helps structure our conversations to push each other as we were finishing and kind of revising chapters. And so that's what I really love about this book, is that it kind of outlines those in the beginning, in the first chapter. But then each chapter begins and ends with those seven concepts. Mm-hmm. So there's like guiding questions, because it's a pretty meaty book. It's got so much great stuff in there that each chapter, you can really kind of choose where you are in your journey as far as around assessment. And you don't have to read it in order. So I think you can kind of see, that's why I feel like it's so hard to pick a chapter, because everyone is so unique and great in its way, but there's this connection and cohesion with the seven core concepts. So when you go to each chapter, there's a list of guiding questions to start you off to think about identity and to think about asset mindsets and to think about partnerships and to think about learner clarity and our seven concepts. And then there's a reflection at the end. So I think that just really helps the reader kind of see those consistent concepts throughout this process. It really helped us kind of solidify our thinking. And so I think that's just a really easy way to kind of enter. You have all these different entry points. Once you kind of get like your base, you're like, okay, now where am I ready to go? Which one do I want to tackle? Am I really going to work on my questioning? Am I going to work on some, maybe some partnering with families? Am I going to work on some practice? So I think you can go any direction. So that's what I really, truly like about this.
Thank you for sharing that. That was actually one of my favorite parts as well, that framing, not just in the beginning, but throughout each of the chapters. And so I want to ask a quick question, because I know Isaac is going to jump away. So if we can get him on before he boards his plane, and, he'll listen to this, because he's going to have an amazing flight. He'll be safe. He'll land. Everything will be okay. So my question with this is that the people who are listening to this, right, obviously go out and get the book. That's step one. But if they're thinking, you know what, the school year's over, I'm utilizing the summer, I'm thinking about next year, what is one practical takeaway that, as I'm thinking about becoming a more culturally responsive and sustaining assessor, what could be one practical thing that I can do, you know, when on day one, starting when I go back to the building?
Yeah, so something that will help with this is on Mimi and Todd Press is the publisher of this book. And so if they search Mimi and Todd Press, Amplify Learner Voice Resources, there's a set of resources that are matched to the book. So for each chapter, there might be, hey, here's some questions you could ask. Here's a sample letter you might send to parents, caregivers, and community members. Here's some videos of kids or educators in action talking about their journey or working through a process. But I would say kind of the first step, similar to what we talked about with the formative assessment process, is we have to partner with the learners. So to think ahead, and you can get some of these from those resources, but what kind of questions can I ask my students? Or if I'm in administration, what kind of questions can I ask the teachers and other educators that I support to better understand who they are, where they're coming from, and to help them and ourselves understand what kind of strengths that they are already bringing, what assets they have from their lived experience?
Thank you so much. Now go do that slow movie run. Don't run through the walkway. Don't get in trouble. I can imagine the Chariots of Fire playing, right? Is he like to do? So Connie, Dr. Twyman, do you any practical advice that you might have if somebody were to come to you? Or maybe this is something, you know, that you finish off, you know, when you're working with your teachers, like what is that thing that they could walk away with?
I think like for me, it's a journey, you know, and like when we can always do better. Like we're looking at, when we look at curriculum, you know, I remember the teachers that pulled out their files and they had, you know, take the dust off of the lesson plans that they had for 15 years. And then there's this notion of the teachers that just never do the same lesson plan. Like they're always learning what the students need, what is happening in the world, what's happening with technology, what can I do to be current and relevant? And I think adding that additional layer of what do the students bring, what do the students need, and how can I make those types of adjustments? Wherever people are in the learning journey, they're ready for this book. They're ready for a different book to get them started. But anytime you're looking at something that has you kind of scratching your head or wondering or maybe even like looking internally, like, do I really do that? No. When your defenses start to kick in, that's really the time to just make sure that you have some trusted people in your inner circle so that you can check yourself in a way that helps you to grow, and that it isn't about being, like I said, it isn't about being defensive or trying to be perfect. We all have our own lived experiences. And as we grow and we age and we have more experiences, then we expand. And that's the beauty of life and our individual journeys.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I think I would just add, I think one of my words that I always come back to in thinking about where our current practice is, and well, one, two things. One is like my favorite saying, actually, this is a quote that we have. I think it's literally on the, in the first page, in the first chapter, is start where you are, but don't stay there. Mm-hmm. So wherever you are in the assessment, same like Connie's saying, is this journey. That's great. We're not throwing out, we're not revamping and having to throw everything out. Cause I think that's also some fear for teachers when we start talking about culturally responsive, sustained education, is that it's something new. It's another layer. It's an addition. It's something extra. It really becomes a mindset over time. Like the journey that you take and using kind of, you know, the framework and using some of like the foundational tenets of the theories that this book is grounded in, it becomes a way of thinking. So the way that we approach assessment, the way that we talk about data, the way that we group students, the way that we share information and give feedback, all of that will come with this different lens. And so it's more about being intentional. So I think we're taking practices that we maybe have done and maybe have done really well, and then just adding some intentionality to it so that we're providing more opportunities and more alternative ways for students, again, to show who they are and what they know. Because we're, again, still just missing so many opportunities to see, to let our students have that success. And so I think there's just, success looks different for many students and many families and many, you know, in our different communities. So let's give all of our kids as many opportunities to show that and to be successful.
Thank you. I think it's just really important, right? As we're doing this work, I'm hearing about this idea of having this journey, right? And I'm thinking about just, because now all these different things are running through my head as things that I'm reading, things that I'm preparing for, things that I'm having conversations with my teachers. And you're right. It's this idea, like I don't want to say it as an excuse, but in a way it is, right? Like I want to be as ready as I possibly can. Like, no, just start, like just begin doing the work and you'll get there, right? You're never going to be perfect. You're never going to have it all together. Like it is this journey. And so taking those two ideas together, right? Start somewhere and realize it's a journey and lean into that journey and continue to learn and to grow. And so I think it's powerful. And so, you know, as we begin to, I guess, close this part out, and I know Isaac's no longer with us here, we could obviously find the book, right? We've mentioned where they can find that book, but each of you are phenomenal educators in your own right. So if somebody says, yeah, the book's amazing, I'm getting a lot out of it, but I also want to connect with each of you individually, how can they do that? Where can they find you? So Dr. Twyman, I'll kick off with you and then we'll jump over to Connie.
I think through our team is really, you know, through the CORE Collaborative, we are definitely all centrally kind of located through that organization on their website as in our different realms. So I think that's a way, and to even just kind of, and anyone who reaches out to the Core Collaborative knows our team and knows how to, you know, get in touch with us very easily. I think I know Connie is too, on Twitter is another way to kind of reach out and message that way and to start connecting. Those are kind of like my two. I mean, I also have a LinkedIn, but I think like Twitter is probably a little bit better maybe that way.
Okay. Thank you. So no MySpace. I get it.
Oh man. I was so sad when we had to kill my MySpace. Yes.
Old enough, but I wasn't hip enough to have a MySpace.
I was like just in that almost old, but I tried to be hip with my students, only to talk to my students. It was so funny. Yeah.
Yeah, I would just reiterate what Ingrid said, that anybody who wants to partner or learn more about Amplify, definitely it's thecorecollaborative.com. If there's something specific that they want to question or dig in a little bit deeper that they heard one of us say in the podcast and, you know, just want to have a conversation, then reaching out to Twitter, or I have a website, and we're all pretty easy to find. Just Google our names and you'll find a way to get in touch with us. But yeah, all of our partnering work associated with Amplify goes through Core Collaborative.
Well, I just want to close off by saying just thank you, right? Not just for being on the show, obviously, thank you for being in this space and allowing me to connect with you, but just thank you for doing this work. You know, this book, I think, like I said, is powerful, and if done properly, it could help with the shifts that we've been talking about, you know, before pandemic, right? Then COVID hit and we're like, this is it. This is the catalyst. And then we kind of went back to normal, but maybe it'll help us get over that hump. And so I will say that it has been part of my conversations with some of my colleagues and just kind of driving some of those, right? Those guiding questions, right? Like, so are you saying that you don't believe? No, of course I do. Like, so now, utilizing this summer as we're having these conversations into next year, what do assessments really look like in our space? So I don't know if I would have been able to have all the tools necessary and to bridge those gaps without a text like this. So thank you so much for not, like I said, not just being on the show, but for the work that you're doing. So thank you. I would definitely make sure that any of the show notes, all of this information is shared out with the listeners, those of you checking in. But other than that, you know, thank you for being in this space. Thank you for sharing. And I'm looking forward to our paths. I know Connie and I, our paths are constantly crossing now, which I'm thankful for. But Dr. Twyman, I hope to be able to connect with you as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Wonderful evening. And we'll talk soon.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Good to see you again, Charles.
I want to thank you for listening to the Counter Narrative Podcast. If you're enjoying the show, please be sure to like, subscribe, and of course, share it with friends and family. I'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show, so please leave a comment or two as well. Now, I'm not sure what platform you're using, but the show can be found on Anchor, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and plenty of other platforms. If the show isn't on your preferred site, let me know, and I'll be sure to get it up and running. This podcast is also featured on schoolrubric.com, where you can find educational articles, videos, and interviews with educators from around the globe. Be sure to connect with me and other listeners by following the show on Twitter at the CN Podcast and joining the show's Facebook group. Take care.